persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention, as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, everyone. We're here today for oral arguments. We'll begin with case number one, Shipley versus Chicago Board of Elections. This is case number 17-3511, and we'll begin with Attorney Frenkel.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the court, Nathaniel A. Frenkel here on behalf of plaintiff appellants. So today we're here regarding a case that happened before the that occurred during March 23rd through March 29th, 2016, during the last federal presidential primary election. There were 2,000 volunteers that went to the Chicago Board of Elections to a warehouse to witness the mandatory 5% audit recount of votes from both early voting machines and 5% of precincts on election day. The purpose
Mr. Frenkel, before we get too far into the substance, your opening brief notes that you're acting pro se, I'm not sure if that was just something left over. I want to just confirm with you, please, that you are representing all the remaining plaintiffs.
I am representing all the remaining plaintiffs, Your Honor. You're very welcome. Purpose of the recount that I was alluding to before is required by state law. It's to ensure votes are cast accurately and counted. And, you know, what the volunteers witnessed that day really shocked them. They saw Board of Elections employees failing to count votes, Board of Elections employees failing to tally votes on the tally sheets used to track the count, Board of Elections employees changing final tabulated vote counts, knowing they were inaccurate. Same Board of Elections employees.
Mr. Frenkel,
yes.
Excuse me for interrupting you.
Oh,
can I just ask you a question to just clarify a contextual point?
Of course, Your Honor.
Was that at the those observations, did they occur at the polling place or at the audit site?
I believe they were all at the audit site, Your Honor.
Okay. And the audit site and the polling place are neither one and the same, nor are they are those things occurring at the exact same time, correct?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question, please?
The polling place and the audit site are not one and the same.
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you, Aaron. And then moreover, there were employees who were attempting to perform accurate counts, which were frustrated by the supervisors of the Board of Elections and replaced with other employees to serve their own purposes, and that's stated in paragraphs 31 of the complaint and 26, or pardon me, of the brief, which are pages 12 to 14 from the Trent, specifically regarding the, on pages 12 to 14, my apologies. So state law requires the Board of Elections to report to its own governing board whether the audit recount resulted in an errorless count or whether there were discrepancies.
And your claim in count one is based solely on the audit rule, correct? And the 5%?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's primarily what it's based on as far as, basically the infallibility of the audit, and, among other things.
And if the district court's statutory interpretation was correct, that a vote cannot be changed based on the 5% audit rule, how can you state a claim? And I understand you dispute the first part of that.
Sure.
But assuming that statutory construction is accurate and a vote can't be changed based on any irregularities found through an audit, how can you state a claim?
Well, for a variety of factors. One is that the actual 5% auditing test itself is the only remedy to cure any sort of voting inaccuracies and...
But the question would be, what's the remedy?
Oh, my apologies.
The audit, the statute says a written report can be filed and it can be taken from there.
Mm-hmm.
But again, assume the preface of the question is accurate, that the under this statute, you can't change any votes, or the Election Commission can't change any votes based on that audit, regardless of how irregular it might be or the problems that you observed with it, how can you state a claim?
Well, in regards to that, the statute in and out of itself, and specifically 24C15, which the defendants cite to, has a lot of there's a lot of issues with that particular statute, and the fact that there's a lot of erroneous matters that are referred or pardon
again,
me,
put referenced. All of that aside, put all of the potential issues with the statute. Let's assume that that audit statute does not allow the Election Commission to make any kind of changes in votes based on the final results of the audit. Mm-hmm. How can you state a claim then based on that audit provision?
Well, again, the finality as far as the actual audit is concerned is really kind of what the issue is, if that makes sense to the court. The finality of the test...
If your claim is that your clients were deprived of their right to vote, mm-hmm. and if the statute doesn't allow any changes in votes that were cast, how can your clients be deprived of their right to vote?
Well, again, they're deprived of the right to vote as far as their voting interests are concerned. Now, they're deprived of the right to vote because their votes aren't being properly calculated and their votes aren't properly being tabulated. So with the 5% auditing test, it's a test that has a lot of fallibility with in and out of itself.
That I share, I think, the disconnect there, okay? Because when you look at C-15 does seem to contain language in the first large paragraph that would allow precinct officers to correct errors that occur at the polling place. I mean, that's just in the text of the statute. Okay, your claim is not about anything that happened at the polling place. Your claim is about something that happened on another day at an audit location. And as I hear Judge St. Eve's question, what she's saying is in the second part of the statute, for better or for worse, the Illinois legislature made clear that whatever happens in an audit cannot affect final election results. So that presents a pleading barrier for you, or at least a pleading challenge for you.
And I understand the court's point in all those regards. What I can say is that her claim states that the ballots that were cast were not counted before the audit actually took place. So it's kind of a timing issue.
But the board doesn't count the ballots at the audit. They're checking the returns made by the election officials.
Right. Well, again, like I think that's in a way just kind of like skipping to one part as far as the actual 5% auditing test, where we're saying that the ballots themselves that were cast, they weren't counted before the audit took place. So the audit itself wouldn't actually have any cognizable effects on the actual votes that are at issue.
How can you state a claim then that your clients were deprived of their right to vote?
Well, there later on, with one of the votes specifically, and again, there's a variety of issues involved in this case. There were votes that were essentially just counted improperly. Now, while the ballots
at the polling place or at the audit site?
At both, Your Honor.
No, hold on.
Sure.
I don't read your complaint to allege any misconduct at the polling place as voting was occurring.
And
if I'm mistaken, can you point me to where that's alleged in your complaint? At the polling place, not at the audit site.
Sure. I to be completely honest with the court, I couldn't at this immediate moment. I would talk to co-counsel regarding that.
You'll have some rebuttal time.
Rebuttal.
Yeah.
But I couldn't point to that particular issue right now, Your Honor.
And that goes, Judge Scudder, one of his first questions to you was just confirming that this was based on conduct at the audit, not at the polling place. So what you're saying now is something different than what you responded to.
Right. Well, the central tabulation itself doesn't take place at the auditing facility. So it's not the audit in and out of itself that would be specifically at issue regarding the specific question there. Rather, it would be the votes that were cast prior to the audit taking place. And the audit is used more as a check on those particular votes.
So, Mr. Frankel, the challenge, though, is that you've got a constitutional claim that you've brought with regard to these two Illinois statutes. The Illinois statutes themselves, if you're asking this court to do an analysis of those statutes, you've got to bring in an allegation of a constitutional deprivation. And that's what the panel is exploring with you. What is that constitutional deprivation? If it's not anyone being deprived of the right to vote or something that can't change the result of the election, how do your clients have a constitutional claim?
Well, there's a constitutional claim under the First and 14th Amendments as far as the freedom of assembly and as far as the actual votes not being counted, again, that's an issue where the claim is that the votes themselves aren't being counted. Rather, the claim is that regarding the central tabulation, there was errors regarding those votes being counted at a latter time.
If the latter time is at the audit site,
correct, and as well as the certification that occurred thereafter
after the audit,
correct.
You may continue, unless you wish to reserve the rest of your time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. So, the appeal really presents the issue, again, does the right to vote include, and as we were talking about just beforehand, does the right to vote include the right to have that vote counted? And, the district court initially denied defendant's motion to dismiss in a well-written opinion. And then for reasons that are not exactly clear from the record, it reversed itself, saying it had drawn all inferences in the plaintiff's favor when it clearly hadn't done so. It seized on an isolated reading of the Illinois law, and the district court itself concluded that the voters' rights could not have been violated because the report produced by this fraudulent procedure could not be used to change an election result that was already certified. As was alluded to before, this moreover ignores the plain fact that at the time of the count, the result had not been certified, and at the very hearing where the vote was to be certified, plaintiffs attempted to present evidence of the inaccuracies regarding the count. But they were not allowed to present this information. Rather, the Board of Elections performed a gavel-to-gavel meeting to certify the result and only allowed public comment after the certification of the clearly erroneous and inaccurate count. The district court ignores the facts pled in the complaint and precedent regarding 12b-6 motions, in their opinion. And at the time of the recount, there was no certified final vote result that plaintiffs were seeking to challenge. Rather, plaintiffs were merely trying to determine whether their votes and others were being accurately counted, and this clearly, again, this is something we were alluding to before, goes into the constitutionally protected right to vote, and specifically the right to have that particular vote counted. And, you know, again, we would say that the district court got it correct the first time. They were incorrect the second time. And I will reserve the rest of my time here for rebuttal. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Frankel. We'll now hear from Mr. Burns.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Daniel Burns, and I represent the Chicago Board of Election Commissioners and James M. Scanlon. Because Section 24C15 of the Illinois Election Code cannot change anyone's vote, appellants cannot state a claim that their right to vote was violated. The district court properly recognized as such and granted our motion to dismiss with prejudice. Two provisions of the Illinois Election Code largely should guide this court's analysis. The first, as mentioned, is Section 24C-15, and the second provision is the discovery provision found in Section 22.9.1. Section 22.9.1 is mentioned in Section 24C-15. So all the allegations in plaintiff's complaint pertain to Section 24C-15. And as that title suggests of the code, it provides three subjects. The first is the official precinct return. Second is the check of totals, and the third is the audit, or the 5% auditing test from which plaintiff's allegations arise from. The next four sentences after the check of after the official return of precinct refers to the check of totals. This allows for the election authority, in this case the Chicago Board of Elections, if they discover an obvious discrepancy in the total number of votes cast in any precinct, to correct the vote, to correct the return. But this section is unrelated to the 5% auditing test that is the basis of appellant's allegations contained in their second amended complaint. This is important because the board is created by statute, and it can only do what is provided for it by the Illinois legislature through the Illinois Election Code. And Section 24C only authorizes the board to canvass votes solely on the certificates of results prepared by the judges of election. It does not allow the Chicago Board of Elections to canvass votes with the results of the 5% auditing test.
Can you speak to why the legislature structure the statute that way? What's your best estimation?
Well, Judge, you know, the legislature has provided numerous provisions to protect the right to vote in this case. They provide in Section 24C-9 for the equipment to be tested prior to the election, and an errorless count must be provided before that equipment is allowed to be used. In this instance, there's also the State Board of Elections, which has the final say. So I believe that the way they structure it is, they don't want to give too much power to the local canvassing boards to control an otherwise statewide result in this instance.
But if suppose that in, you know, some circumstance an audit, the 5% audit, showed very, very substantial irregularities. Why would the legislature set up a statutory scheme that did not allow those irregularities to actually inform or to authorize revisiting a precinct return?
Well, I think it does, Judge. Because there are two provisions that candidates can use in order to determine more information. So the 5% auditing test only allows for 5% of the precincts or 5% of the early voting machinery. However, if the candidate takes advantage of the discovery petition, they can pick 25% of the precincts they want to look at. They can also file an election contest when everything can be looked at again. So this 5% auditing equipment test is just one part of this scheme that the Illinois legislature has put together in order to safeguard the vote and provide for prompt, orderly elections.
What's the purpose of the written report that is provided for in 24C15?
The written report is provided if there's an errorless count that cannot be performed, and the point is to show where the errors occurred. It's then sent to the Illinois State Board of Elections, who can then do what they will with it if they can.
Who's responsible for preparing that written report?
That's the Chicago Board of Elections.
Is that something the plaintiffs could have prepared, or does it have to be by the Board of Elections?
It has to be by the Board of Elections, and the report is publicly available, so it is available to the plaintiffs as well.
Do you know if a report was prepared here? I know there isn't an allegation about it.
Yes.
Do you know if one was prepared?
There was a report prepared, Judge.
What happened with that report?
It was sent to the Illinois State Board of Elections, and I'm not sure if anything beyond that had happened.
If there were improprieties at the audit, what type of a claim should plaintiffs have brought to challenge those? Would it have been through their report?
Well, that's one issue, but ultimately, if they have a problem with the way the process went, their remedy is in Illinois State Court. They could seek a lawsuit there for violation of the state law. It's not a federal claim here. So, and as I explained with that, the report, that is publicly available, and they could look at it if they want to, and also it goes to the State Board of Elections after that. But finally, most importantly, Section 24C-15 refers to Section 22-9.1, which says explicitly, the results shall not be certified, used to amend or change the abstracts of the votes previously completed, used to deny the successful candidate for the same office his certificate of nomination or election. So at this point, it's set forth explicitly that this 5% equipment test cannot be used to change the vote. And because all of plaintiff's allegations pertain to this 5% auditing test, they cannot state a claim that their right to vote was violated.
Your argument is that they can't state a claim, but am I correct in reviewing the briefs that you haven't argued that they lack Article III standing?
In this, I argue in certain points for certain claims that they have brought up newly on appeal that they lack
on the standing. Right on the right to vote claim in particular. In your view, have they satisfied the requirements of Article III standing?
I believe so. Yes, Judge. But, and as counsel mentioned, that he spoke about how they amended their complaint afterwards, but it really doesn't matter how many details they've added or more facts they've pleaded when the same allegations pertain to this 5% auditing test, which can't change the results of the election or change any votes. Plaintiffs also bring two other claims, a right to freedom of association and a right to petition the government claims. However, I don't think the court need to consider it because they're not really developed on appeal. There's very little case law in support. But even if this court wishes to look at it, the allegations are that they're obstructed from viewing or photographing the tallies, that board members made hostile comments, and they misled the plaintiffs. But as the district court correctly noted, it's not even clear with whom the plaintiffs believe they were prevented from associating with. They were present at the 5% auditing test. They were allowed in. They were at the April 5th board meeting as well. So I don't see how they could state a claim for freedom of association. And likewise, the right to petition the government. They made clear in their allegations that they brought these claims of discrepancies to the board, but that the board didn't correct the discrepancies as they wanted. And as this court has noted, the government may not interfere with the right to petition, but the government cannot interfere with the right to petition, but it need not grant the petition, no matter how meritorious it may be. So plaintiffs' own allegations show that they have not established a right to freedom of association. Finally, plaintiff raises a host of new issues on appeal. They raise for the first time an equal protection claim. I don't think the court should consider this. It's only two sentences long, their argument, and it was never raised in the district court. And then finally, because they have failed to state a federal claim, this court should dismiss count three or affirm the dismissal of count three because an active case or controversy is necessary for declaratory injunctive relief. If there are any questions.
No, thank you, Mr. Burns.
Thank you. We ask that you affirm the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Burns.
Thank you.
Mr. Frankel will recognize you for rebuttal.
Specifically regarding section 22.9.1, and we do make certain to point this out in our reply brief, this was all done within 5 days after the last day for proclamation of the results of any canvass, declaring persons nominated, elected, or declared eligible for a runoff election. This changes the abstracts of the vote. And I really do emphasize abstracts because that specifically means that these weren't official votes yet. We're not saying that you can't change votes, but we're referring to abstracts again, specifically. The previously declared result of the vote was on a question of public, or pardon me, in 9.1, they specifically do say when these votes should be used to change the previously declared result of the vote on a question of public policy. Moreover, the statute simply does not support the defendant's and the district court's interpretation, not only because the previously declared result of the vote concerns public policy, but also because the ballots and voting records at issue were not previously declared at all times relevant to the plaintiff's complaints. The early votes go to the central tabulator, and there's only one time that they have in regards to those ballots being offered to really examine that. The declared result that the statute references is a result that's not extant at the time that the retabulation took place, and thus that renders defendants and the district court's entire premise that this provision meant that the audit could not change any votes entirely illusory. Plaintiffs do not specifically seek to change votes on any public policy questions. They seek to change votes as a matter of constitutional right, and nor are there any observations of voting records being used for being used to overturn proclamation that had not yet taken place at the time. Opposing counsel references federal standing, but as this court pointed out, there is Article III standing, as they clearly accepted within their response. While there are state law issues, these state law issues are more appropriate to be heard within the confines of a federal court due to Article III, among other things. If we also contrast Section 24B15, it specifically says an additional part of this check prior to the proclamation, whenever a discrepancy exists during the canvass of votes between the unofficial results and the certificate of results, the ballots for that precinct shall be retabulated to correct the return, which goes to a variety of points that the plaintiff appellants are making. I would like to point out, in regards to defendants' arguments under Monell, they cite to this honorable court as far as certain precedent goes, defining a single incident being insufficient. And I don't believe that, A, there was a single incident, but even arguendo, if there was a single incident, this is a case where the Supreme Court's actually made it quite clear that there doesn't have, there can be a single incident. And, you know, this is conduct that's been ongoing. This is conduct that's currently salient. So with all that being said, you know, plaintiff appellants would respectfully request that this court reverse and remand the Northern District of Illinois and grant plaintiff's appeal.
Thank you, Mr. Frenkel. Thank you, Mr. Burns. The case will be taken under advisement.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.